Good evening, all you brave souls, undaunted by raw night. So the title of this evening's talk is I Vow to be Maladjusted. So you say, there's one vow I can probably keep.
Should be a short talk.
And so this is, the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And so my title actually comes from him. I went to the MLK march this morning. I missed most of the breakfast. I woke up really early with a bad headache and went back to sleep. So I got there towards the end of the breakfast and missed all the talks and the gospel choir. But I had a wonderful conversation with a black couple next to me in the balcony about homelessness in the Springs. And we'll have to have another conversation because there was just so much that they didn't know about it and were really, really curious. They ended up saying, gosh, this information needs to be more widely available. So anyway, just a really nice conversation, getting to know them a little bit. And then went to the march and walked in the cold morning, you know, behind the amazing Palmer High School drum line. I don't know if any of you have ever heard them. I hadn't heard them before. Wow, they're so good. It just felt like dancing down the street. Whew. And I love those walks. I love the MLK walks because you can walk along next to one person a little while and then somebody else a little while, and you just kind of all sort of mix around with each other depending on your pace and, you know, whatever. And you don't know really exactly why anybody is there, including yourself. And yet, in some other, like, bodily way, you know exactly that you're all there together at the heart of it somehow. So you don't know, and yet you know something in that other way. So I'd like to start with a quote from Dr. King. And then I'd like to weave in a theme, a sutra, and a koan that I'm bringing into the practice period about being maladjusted, about vows, about practice. So Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in a talk at a university on December 18th of 1963 said some other things and then said, certainly we all want to avoid the maladjusted life. And now at that time in the 60s, that word maladjusted was thrown around a lot. So he was sort of riffing on that. In order to have real adjustment within our personalities, we all want the well-adjusted life in order to avoid neurosis, schizophrenic personalities, etc. But I say to you, my friends, as I move to my conclusion, there are certain things in our nation and in the world which I am proud to be maladjusted to, and which I hope all men of goodwill will be maladjusted until the good societies realize. I say very honestly that I never intend to become adjusted to segregation and discrimination. I never intend to become adjusted to religious bigotry. I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few. I never intend to adjust myself to the madness of militarism, to self-defeating effects of physical violence. So I never intend to adjust myself. That's a sort of vow. Yeah? And it's a statement about his practice. And I'd like to tack it up for you next to the Buddha's advice for those who would wish to take up the path of the Bodhisattva in the Diamond Sutra. Subhuti asks, if someone sets forth on the Bodhisattva path, how should they stand? How should they walk? And how should they control their thoughts? And the Buddha, the Bhagavan, says, those who would now set forth on the Bodhisattva path should give birth to this thought. So it's a long thought, so hang in there. It says, however many beings there are, in whatever realms of being might exist, whether they're born from an egg or born from a womb, born from the water or born from the air, whether they have form or no form, whether they have perception or no perception, or neither perception nor no perception, in whatever conceivable realm of being one might conceive of beings, in the realm of complete nirvana, I shall liberate them all. I'm going to do a little translating there. In the realm of complete nirvana, we could say, in the realm of complete simplicity, I shall liberate them all. And though I thus liberate countless beings, not a single being is liberated. Not a single being is liberated. And he goes on to explain that this needs to be done also as one is aware that there is no one to do the saving, and no saving is done. Nothing is accomplished, right? In that whole long thought that he says to be a bodhisattva, we should give birth to that thought. In that whole long thought, nothing is accomplished, right? And yet, at all times, he says, we can simply give birth to this thought, and the benefit of this one thing will be beyond immeasurable. It's sort of a no try, just do move. Yeah. Now, does this sound like the statement of a well-adjusted person? not to me. So, and can you hear the resonance with what Dr. King says? We're never to adjust ourselves. We're never to give birth to the thought that this is just the way it is, I can't do anything about it. That's not the thought he's talking about, is it? Because to do that is to turn our back on what is. And on our own connection to it. And yet, if we harden ourselves against it, and make it what's wrong with this life, make it a thing to be saved, and ourselves a savior, and that there is saving involved, we've made an adjustment in spite of ourselves. That's a kind of adjustment, right? I'm against this. This is wrong. I'm going to fix it, right? That's a kind of adjustment because we have made a box around it. So in a way, when we follow this teaching, we're accepting the wisdom of no escape. And this is the place where Buddhas are born, where awakening enters the world. The place of being maladjusted, of not making adjustments, of not making things work out, fit, not making sense of everything. Abiding nowhere, we bring forth our heart-mind, the koan says. Yeah? Abiding nowhere, it ain't easy. So, what else does our tradition say about what this might look like? Not by explanation, but by example. Zen doesn't like to explain, doesn't like to say, it is this, it likes to say, it's kind of like this. So, this one, most of you, I think, have heard before, this koan, Prajnatara turns the wheel. A king of eastern India invited Prajnatara to a vegetarian meal. The king asked, why don't you read from the sutras, which was the normal sort of well-adjusted monk or nun thing to do when you went to a dinner. You were expected to turn the wheel by reciting the sutras. And in fact, people were paid to or their monastery was paid to read as many sutras as they could in a given period of time. So they would recite the sutras really fast so that the merit of reciting the sutra was given to the person who had requested it. And so for that, you would get paid. So why don't you read from the sutras? And Prajnacharya said, I'm a poor person of the way. When I breathe in, I don't live in the world my mind makes. When I breathe in, I don't live in the world my mind makes. And when I breathe out, I don't get caught up in the world of cause and effect. That's the wheel of the sutras I'm always turning. 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 scrolls. Why don't you read from the sutras? I'm a poor person of the way. When I breathe in, I don't live in the world my mind makes. And when I breathe out, I don't get caught up in the world of cause and effect. So I keep not adjusting, right? That's the wheel of the sutras I'm always turning. 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 scrolls. So I want to bring in another point here. Martin Luther King talked about what he won't do, right? The Buddha insists on what we are not doing if we want to take up the walk of the way. What is not so? And Prajnatara speaks in terms of what she does not do. Interesting, huh? And sometimes people are often puzzled by this, but also really bothered by it. And you notice in our precepts are stated as, I won't do this and I won't do that, right? I vow not to. And so I'd like to point out the power of this. The odd power of this maladjustment. When you describe only what you don't or won't do, so when Prajnatara breathes in and gives up the temptation to live in that world of the thoughts, right? The temptation to believe everything you think, the world that your thoughts want to construct for you. And when she breathes out and doesn't immediately go into that world of cause and effect. When you describe only what you don't or won't do, you leave completely and wide open the field of what you can do. You have not made a box around that at all. It's open. You're not defining it, you're not pegging it down. You shake off the definitions and hold in your heart your one vow. And all your energy is then available to actually meet what comes to meet you. Yeah? You've shaken off all the adjustments and the accommodations and the definitions. You're free. Free to move, free to meet what comes to meet you. So, here's one more example I'd like to bring in. Very familiar to some of you, I'm sure, from Mary Oliver. And it's a summer poem, so go figure. Here we are. Maybe it'll warm you up a little. And she starts with a question. She starts with what she doesn't know. So see if you notice these themes weaving through also this poem. Yeah? And she ends up with a question for herself, for us. That's the wheel of the sutras that she's turning in this poem, The Summer Day. And she starts with a question. You know, it's one of those sort of absurd questions that we don't really allow ourselves to say out loud, but it's always there, right? The impermissible question. She starts, who made the world?
I'm sorry, I was blowing my nose. Could you say that again?
Who made the world?
Thank you.
Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Where I'd like to leave us, which is with the Diamond Sutra. And what brought me back to it was this thing that was on TV. There was a brief talk by a man who I think was born in India, an American who had started his life in India. And he was talking about people always were asking him, are you American or are you Indian? Did you see somebody saw it? You did.
Yes.
Okay, well, help me fill in the gaps if I haven't remembered it clearly. But it was a really interesting short presentation. And he said, well, it used to be that if an Indian asked me, I'd say I'm American, right? And if an American asked me, I'd say I'm Indian. And then as time went along, I realized I was always saying I'm American. And what did that mean to me? People ask, what does that mean to you? And he said, well, I discovered that whatever I met, whatever my own condition was, if I was feeling unhappy or things were troubling or whatever, if I could extend myself to do something helpful, then I felt happier. And that became the way I lived, that I knew that if I could extend myself to do something helpful for someone, I would feel better. That's what I took from it. Did you hear that too? Same thing. And somehow, he connected that with being American. And that was just gorgeous. And so it comes back to, the ultimate result of that experiment of excluding is you end up miserable inside of your big house. And, you know, when your kids go get on drugs and your husband commits suicide, you know, I mean, it doesn't go well. So here's here's the Buddha saying, if you want to walk this bodhisattva path, here's what you do. You give birth to this thought, and this is the ongoing practice of it, right? You give birth to this thought. However many beings there are in whatever realms of being might exist, so you're beyond the inconceivable already, right? Whatever they are, whoever they are, however they appear or don't appear, right? Whether they're visible or invisible, whether they have a form or no form, whether they could perceive me or couldn't perceive me or neither could nor couldn't because the category doesn't even work, right? Whoever they are, in the water, born from water or air, you know, in whatever conceivable realm of being you could even conceive of beings, could we take it any wider than that? You know, whoever it is, I'll liberate them all. There's the ultimate non-exclusion, right? So in your heart, give birth to this thought. Excluding nobody at all, I will liberate them all. I will liberate them all. And that, in other words, that's all I'm about. Whatever I'm doing, that's all I'm about. If I'm, you know, washing the dishes, I'll liberate the dishes. What would that be like? You know, if I'm tending a cut on my hand, I'll liberate my thumb. You know, it's, you know, in the middle of all that activity, I'll remember that I'm actually not liberating anybody, and there's no such thing as liberating, and there's no such thing as I either. Yeah, so practice that.